Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. County supervisors on Tuesday will be considering a proposal to restrict free speech outside the county administration building, create free speech zones for protesters, and impose other restrictions in all county parks and recreation areas. And we'll have details on today's show. The management of La Mesa's Oktoberfest, one of the biggest festivals in East County, is up in the air due to a dispute between the city and a merchants association over unpaid bills from last year's festival. Hear what the merchants did with all that money and what city council members had to say about the merchant group's actions. Boulevard has a new fire station, and we've got details on how it will improve public safety even for those of you who don't live in this rural community. 10-year-old Isabella Keating has been missing from San Diego's Euclid neighborhood since last Wednesday, and police are asking the public help to find her and bring her home. We'll also have an update from the state capitol on the fate of two bills by local San Diego legislators, one that would raise holiday pay for workers and the other that would make California's Made in the USA labeling law conform with federal standards. And then we'll have news about an El Cajon woman identified as the body found washed up near the Ocean Beach Pier. Plus, hear about some wild weather set to hit our area in the next couple of days as the remnants of a tropical cyclone reach San Diego County. On our health report, hear about a spike in West Nile virus in the past month in San Diego. Plus, learn about an increase in California kids who are getting free meals this summer. On the second half of our show today, we'll have two fascinating interviews for you. The first is with Lisa Wood, a long rider who will tell us about her solo rides on horseback, one to Oregon, and the other across the nation, as well as her adventures along the way. And then on Bookshelf, hear from journalist-turned-romance novelist Sarah Jourdain Miller about her steamy stories and the craft of writing. Learn about San Diego Library's Summer Reading Challenge, and then on Green Scene, hear about low energy output at Ocotillo Wind for the second year in a row, and why some critics are suggesting fraud. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters.
For years, community groups and activists have rallied outside the county administration building where supervisors meet. The groups come to protest or urge support for various causes, from immigrant rights to stopping environmentally damaging projects. Rally organizers range from liberal Occupy members to civil liberties advocates to conservative Tea Party groups. But under a proposed new ordinance on the supervisor's agenda this Tuesday, people wishing to exercise their First Amendment rights may soon be restricted to a designated free speech zone at the new waterfront park around the administration building where supervisors meet. You won't be able to bring a megaphone, microphone, or even a chair on which to sit. There will also be noise limits, and gatherings of 200 or more people must obtain permits, meaning you'll have to predict how many will show up for your event or risk paying fines. And that's not all. This proposed ordinance would go even further, changing codes regulating selling and advertising at all county parks and recreational facilities to regulate, quote, other issues such as commercial photography, noise levels, and the prohibition on posting or affixing materials on park property. The specific nature of these changes are not spelled out in the agenda attachments. Does this mean a photographer can't snap photos in a public park and later sell images of flowers, birds, or people? Will people be banned from posting lost dog flyers or event announcements? The stated purpose of the ordinance's proposed free speech zones is to restrict such use of the waterfront park's most heavily used spaces, including walkways and recreational areas, which have become popular with people expressing their First Amendment speech as well as with tourists and recreational users. The county claims it wants to assure, quote, a balance of the recreation/civic use of the waterfront park and the ongoing business use of the County Administration Center and free speech activities. It is unclear why the county didn't foresee such conflicts when it decided to build a waterfront park in the first place, during a drought and with our tax dollars, on grounds long used for free speech activities outside the center of civic government, where supervisors meet to enact laws which impact the public. Recreational activities can occur anyplace, but the cherished right to rally support or opposition for issues up for a vote before our elected officials are clearly less effective if regulated to an obscure area away from the building's entrances and places where the public gathers. This item will be heard this Tuesday, June 9th, by supervisors at the County Administration Building, Room 310 in San Diego. The meeting starts at 9 a.m., and the item is 7th on the agenda. The meeting is open to the public, and those who cherish free speech in public parks can request comment cards before the agenda item is heard. This is Richard Faust with East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
The running of La Mesa's Oktoberfest is up in the air, with the door open for a new organizer to potentially take over. In May, the city of La Mesa received an application from the La Mesa Village Merchants Association to run the entire event this year, cutting out the Chamber of Commerce, which in past years has run the profitable beer garden. But the merchants group still owes the city over $37,000 for past events, including last year's Oktoberfest and the car show. This summer's car show has been canceled due to the merchants' financial woes. The merchants' group hopes to pay off its past debts and cover future costs by running both the beer garden and the rest of the Oktoberfest this year. In addition, the merchants are asking the council to cut the city's cost recovery to just 50%. In previous years, the city council gave the merchants a 50% discount on city fees for the event, based on the assumption that it brings sales tax to the city. But the city has long required 100% cost recovery for police, fire, and public works cost support that's provided by the city. The merchants group has promised to place future proceeds from this year's Oktoberfest into an escrow account so the city would be the first paid from future event revenues. This is not the first time, though, that the Merchants Association's finances have led to a change in the way the city processes applications for special events. In 2011, the council unanimously passed a requirement that applicants must prove their organization's paperwork is in order and that its financial records have been independently audited, according to La Mesa Today, which reported that same month on a dust-up within the Merchants Association over financial reporting inaccuracies and a lack of transparency that led to the loss of some of the association's members. Because the city has requested a single name on the Oktoberfest application, two trade groups, the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce and the La Mesa Village Merchants Association, had an arrangement until now in which the chamber ran the Allison Street Beer Garden and food concessions as well at 4th and La Mesa Boulevard, while the merchants ran everything else and had the responsibility, though, to pay the city event fees. The total bill for last year's Oktoberfest was almost $82,000. The merchants did pay the city nearly $48,000, but $40,000 of that came from the chamber, so the merchants' own contribution toward the debt was less than $8,000. And yet, the merchants paid almost three times that much, $20,000, to its executive director, John Vigil, for his services as the Oktoberfest organizer. That's according to the Merchants Association President Arlene Moore in an interview with East County Magazine. Councilmember Ruth Sterling hammered Guy Blumenthal from the Merchants Association to explain what happened to the rest of the money owed. In the council hearing, Blumenthal offered this surprising explanation.
If we took another $30,000 or $28,000 to throw Christmas in the village.
Okay.
And I guess in hindsight, we probably should have given it to you rather than throwing the Christmas in the village. Because that's the amount of money we're talking about. We were pretty excited about the new mayor and everything else that happened with the election and thought it'd be pretty cool to throw Christmas in the village, have the new mayor walk down the street and greet his appreciative voters. Yes.
So you spent the Oktoberfest money that should have gone to the city because you own the city.
On another city event promoting the city. Yes, we did.
The new mayor and council members ignored the potentially compromising implications by Blumenthal, their outspoken political ally, who implied that the merchants group should use funds owed to the city to promote a political campaign winner. City Manager Dave Witt told the council he wants to be sure that whoever takes over the Oktoberfest event has the resources and qualifications to run it. The event attracts 100,000 visitors each year and is one of the largest in all of East County. Witt made clear that the merchant's decision to spend money owed to the city on a holiday festival rather than paying back the debt left the city in an awkward situation, forcing city staff to send out past due notices. In public comments, representatives of both the merchants and the chamber argued that the city should extend some credit for the annual spike in sales tax during Oktoberfest that benefits the city, and that recovery rates for the event ought to be reduced. Despite possibly being cut out of the event altogether in 2015, chamber member Dave Smiley said the city does benefit and should therefore give a break to the event's organizers. Smiley also gave his assessment of where the blame should lie.
The problem, I believe, with the Merchant Association is really the fact that you had a new person running it this year. They probably incurred a lot more expenses than they anticipated, and it's really an issue of event management than anything else as to why you folks didn't get all your money and how they chose to spend their money. If it was a matter of not having Christmas in the village to make sure the city got paid whole, then maybe that's the decision that should have been made.
But then he added,
and as far as cost recovery goes, it is something that does promote the city from my own perspective, and I've talked about this before. Well, those 3 days then are brought any other time during the year without these two organizations putting the event on. So I would certainly welcome the council adjusting cost recovery in the future to some credit or number for the revenue it does get from this event that are put on by these two organizations, whether we're doing it for our fundraising or not.
While that plan, if approved, could resolve issues in the future, the matter of the outstanding debt remains. Councilwoman Ruth Sterling pointed out that some city residents have complained that they don't even want Oktoberfest, which has become larger, noisier, and requiring more money for security in recent years. Sterling stated adamantly that while the city does not host the event to make money, the costs for police, fire, and public works were paid with taxpayer money that came out of the general fund and must be repaid. And then she made clear,
I cannot see compounding the debt by giving a permit when there's already that taxpayer money outstanding. That just not is a way to do business.
Sterling did voice empathy for the merchants who have struggled in a down economy amid a streetscaping project that has cut into their sales. But she chided the merchants pointedly.
I feel for the situation, believe me, I do. But when you have the money and you know you owe the money, you got to get your priorities straight. I would say the same thing to my children. If they got the rent to pay and they've got other things to pay, if you get your priorities straight and pay the rent, or you're going to be out on the street. Well, you had your priorities. I mean, you had the money, but you spent it on the Christmas festival and you didn't pay your bill.
The newest elected official, however, Councilmember Guy McWhirter, argued in favor of extending credit.
Yeah, it's not apples to apples, and we are not a credit card company, but I don't pay my debts every month on my credit card company, yet they continue to extend me credit, knowing and having faith in me that I'll make good in the future.
McWhirter said he felt comfortable with the merchant's plan to put money into an escrow account for the city, and also suggested he would consider supporting reduction in the cost recovery amount, provided the merchants could give evidence of ability to pay back the rest, since Oktoberfest benefits the city and merchants.
We've talked numerous times about increasing the visibility of downtown La Mesa. Well, I can't think of things that do it better than what we're talking about here. So my opinion is to go ahead with the one application and continue it with the merchants. The thing I like about the merchants, too, is the money that they earn from this, there's no payroll. None of it goes. It all goes directly back into the city. Whether it was misspent on the Christmas in the village, as was alluded, whatever. But I think they are trying to bring benefits to the downtown La Mesa.
The council voted unanimously not to process applications if the applicant has significant outstanding debt to the city, unless the applicant provides the city manager with a secured method of recovery for the city. The council also voted 5-0 to reaffirm its existing policy requiring full cost recovery for the event, unless a specific exemption is later approved by the council. The new wording means the Merchants Association application will not be processed until the group can demonstrate it has the resources to both meet its debt and run the event. so it's back to the drawing board and the negotiating table. The decision also gives the Merchants Association and the Chamber of Commerce time to resolve issues around interpretation of a deal signed in May of last year, which remains in force until October 31st, that's after Oktoberfest. Disruption near carnival rides and the Spring Street trolley by teenagers and gang members have caused increased security costs for the event in the last 3 years, so the Chamber agreed to pay a flat fee of $30,000 and give up its food concession. In return, the merchants granted the Chamber the exclusive first right of refusal to manage and operate that beer garden for this year's Oktoberfest, but now the merchants group wants to renege on that memorandum of understanding. The Chamber interprets the agreement to mean it has the right to run the beer garden unless it chooses not to, but the merchants disagree. It is unclear whether the Chamber's board may seek for the Chamber to try and take over running the entire event, not just the beer garden, but the Chamber's CEO, Mary England, suggested that the field of potential operators for Oktoberfest is now wide open. England told East County Magazine, "Any organization could apply for a special event permit for Oktoberfest. That includes a totally new third party if someone out there wants to step up to run La Mesa's biggest annual party." Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
A brand new fire station is now open in Boulevard. The $3.5 million, 8,000 square foot facility replaces an older station across the street. Capable of housing up to 6 vehicles, the new fire station is the first to house County Fire Authority's services along with Cal Fire firefighters and a paramedic unit under one roof. Supervisor Diane Jacob, who led efforts to secure funding, was on site for a ribbon cutting last week, along with Boulevard Planning Group Chair Donna Tisdale, Cal Fire Chief Tony Meacham, and other local dignitaries. An East County Magazine investigation in 2013 found Boulevard's fire station was closed nearly every day for 3 months due to a shortage of volunteer firefighters and funds. Our report led to allocation of emergency funds to help reopen and staff the station, which has now transitioned to become part of the County Fire Authority. Supervisor Jacob called the new station a huge improvement to public safety for our region. In addition to serving residents, the station's firefighters and paramedics also respond to help motorists when accidents occur along I-8 and other highways in this rural area of East County. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
San Diego police seek help to find Isabella Keating, a 10-year-old girl who disappeared after leaving Horton Elementary School on Wednesday, June 3rd, around 2 p.m. She has not been seen since then. The school is located at 5050 Guymon Street in the Euclid area. Isabella was last seen wearing a lime green shirt and black tights. She is white with brown shoulder-length hair and blue eyes, approximately 4 feet tall, and she weighs 90 pounds. Her foster parent told police that she has run away in the past but normally returns home just hours later, or she's been found promptly and brought home. If you see her or know where she is, please contact the San Diego Police Department at 619-531-2000, and you can see a photo of Isabella Keating on our website at eastcountymagazine.org in our news section.
San Diego Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez served up pumpkin pie to legislators in Sacramento in an effort to win approval for her bill that would require double time pay for most employees forced to work on holidays such as Thanksgiving. The Democratic lawmaker asked colleagues to help her workers receive a piece of the pie for their effort. But one Republican opponent denounced the effort as a turkey of a bill during the floor debate. The measure had support from labor, but was opposed by the California Chamber of Commerce despite an exemption for critical needs workers such as nurses. The Sacramento Bee reports that Assembly Bill 67 gained only 29 votes, falling short of the 42 needed for passage. While employers may be thankful, the defeat comes as a disappointment for workers away from their families on holidays for no extra pay. For East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Leon Thompson.
Legislation authored by Santee Republican Assemblyman Brian Jones to reform California's Made in America labeling laws for products has passed the Assembly and now heads to the State Senate. California currently has tougher standards than the federal government. In California, it is illegal to advertise a product as American-made if any portion of it is made outside the U.S. Jones' measure, Assembly Bill 312, would require that if a product meets federal guidelines, it could be sold in California and labeled Made in America. The Federal Trade Commission's manual states that a product must be made of, quote, all or virtually all, unquote, domestic components to qualify for a Made in America label. Jones says, the current California threshold is not only bad for business, it is bad for the consumer too. Some items aren't even available in the United States, he notes, such as screws and other small negligible parts. He also adds, this legislation will provide an opportunity for California to successfully compete with other states and nations for jobs and investments without removing consumer protections. This bill is also supported by the California Manufacturers and Technology Association. Tony Maglica, founder, president, investor, and chief of MAG Instrument, calls California's Made in USA requirements outdated in the half century since it was passed, noting the globalization of trade has advanced to the point that almost every product of any complexity has at least some non-US origin content, even if the product is engineered and assembled in America and has most of its parts made in America by an American workforce. But the California Consumer Federation opposes the bill. In a letter to a key committee chair, Executive Director Richard Holaber wrote that the measure would actually weaken consumer protections, noting that under the federal standard, for example, New Balance shoes could claim their products were made in America despite 30% of its components coming from overseas. A 2013 Gallup poll indicates that 60% of Americans are willing to pay more for a Made in the USA product. The California Consumer Federation's director points out. He concludes, AB 312 would replace a truth in advertising law that protects consumers who care about the origin of the products they buy with a vague standard that invites mislabeling. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Richard Faust.
San Diego County Crime Stoppers and investigators from the Ramona and Poway Sheriff Stations want your help to identify and find two suspects wanted in a series of vehicle burglaries. The crime spree started in Poway, where there have been 7 burglaries since May 10th targeting landscapers' vehicles at apartment complexes. The thieves stole leaf blowers, trimmers, and other equipment. A similar crime occurred in Ramona on May 25th, and the suspects' descriptions there matched those in a May 18th Poway crime observed by a witness. The suspects drove a 2001 silver or gray Honda two-door sedan with California license plate 4N0G855. The vehicle was recently sold, and there is no updated owner information available, according to authorities. Detectives are asking anybody who witnessed any of the incidents to call the Poway Sheriff Station at 858-513-2800. If you have information on the identity or the location of the suspects, you can also call Crime Stoppers Anonymous tip line at 888-580-8477. Crime Stoppers is offering up to a $1,000 reward to anybody with information that leads to an arrest in this case. Anonymous email and text messages can also be sent via sdcrimestoppers.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
An El Cajon mother is mourning the loss of her 20-year-old daughter, Victoria Zupkis, whose body was found in the surf off the Ocean Beach Pier on May 28th. Zupkis' mother had reported her daughter missing 2 days earlier when she went to visit a friend in Ocean Beach and never returned. The medical examiner's office used dental records to identify Zupkis, but her body was too decomposed to determine the cause of death. Toxicology tests have been ordered, but results will take several weeks to complete. There was no sign of foul play, and the San Diego Police Department has indicated it is not investigating the death as a homicide. The San Diego Union Tribune reports that Zupkis was an award-winning gymnast who also worked with an acrobatic troupe in Mexico, where her father, Steven Zupkis, resides. He has reportedly hired a private investigator to look into what happened to his daughter. Friends told 10 News that Zupkis was a strong swimmer, and the circumstances of her death remain a mystery. A memorial service was held on Friday in El Cajon. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Tropical Cyclone Blanca is making its way north from Baja, Mexico, bringing a threat of rain and thunderstorms to southwestern California. The National Weather Service predicts that rain is expected to begin Monday, with heaviest rainfall in the San Diego area on Tuesday, potentially impacting the evening rush hour and also bringing heavy rains over burned areas in our inland region. Mountain and desert thunderstorms could continue into Wednesday afternoon. Isolated thunderstorms may produce strong erratic winds. There is also a potential for heavy downpours to produce debris flows or flash floods from burn-scarred areas, as well as minor flooding of urban areas and small streams, says Stephen Harrison with the National Weather Service. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Ed Barreno with the Health Report on East County Magazine. The number of dead birds testing positive for West Nile virus in San Diego County has spiked. Only 5 dead birds had tested positive for the disease this year as of May 1st, but a month later that number has jumped to 29, the highest level in the state. The County Environmental Health Department urges people to protect themselves from mosquitoes that can transmit the disease to humans. That includes getting rid of standing water around properties where mosquitoes can breed, wearing insect repellent when outdoors, and reporting dead birds. San Diego County has largely escaped the brunt of West Nile virus since it arrived in Southern California in 2003. But last year, 11 San Diego County residents were diagnosed with the disease, the highest number here since 2009, and 2 people died, both in East County. Dead crows and the disease have been found in Spring Valley, La Mesa, Chula Vista, and Oceanside. The county's vector control program has also found 2 mosquito batches that have tested positive for West Nile virus. For more information about West Nile virus, go to sandiegocounty.gov or download the Fight the Bite phone app.
Nearly 1 in 5 low-income California kids gets free meals in the summer, a better rate than the 1 in 6 who receive summer lunches nationally. That's according to a new report from the nonprofit Food Research and Action Center that finds that 80% of students who normally receive free or reduced-priced lunches during the school year are missing out on summer offerings. Patrice Chamberlain at the California Summer Meal Coalition at the Institute for Local Government says it's a problem of access.
There's a real need for greater awareness and greater support from school district and community leaders to help make sure that these sites are available and that families know about them.
The number of California families using the summer lunch program has gone up for each of the past 2 years. Chamberlain says that's partly because more communities are getting involved and partly because the drought has led to greater poverty among farm worker families.
There's a real human impact to the drought. Parents are either losing jobs entirely or they're working fewer hours or having to work multiple jobs. So families are having to rely more heavily on food assistance programs.
Child nutrition programs are set to be reauthorized by Congress in the fall. The Food Research and Action Center is pushing to expand the number of communities eligible for food assistance and change the rules to allow sites to serve 3 meals a day instead of 2. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. The East County Magazine show airs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, my very special guest is Lisa Wood, who is a Lakeside resident and a long rider. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam.
Can you explain for our listeners exactly what a long rider is?
Well, there's an organization called the Long Riders Guild, and their criteria for whether or not you can be in their guild is you have to have ridden 1,000 miles or more without support.
And we're not talking about on a
car a bicycle here.
No, no. The Long Riders Guild is a horseback rider. So the Long Riders Guild is specifically for people that travel by horseback without support.
Now, you have ridden cross country twice, once from Southern California, Oregon, once from Southern California all the way to Pennsylvania on the East Coast. And I understand you're considering a third one along the old Spanish Trail. What compelled you to get started on this?
Well, a book. I enjoy reading other people's travel books, and I read one that was republished in 1987, so I didn't initially know when I purchased the book that it was about a ride that actually occurred in 1911. But in 1911, a fairly famous Californian named Joseph Smeaton Chase took his horse Chino and rode from his home in the Los Angeles area to the Oregon border. And he published a book about it. It was one of three books about traveling in California that he published. One was his coastal trip. That's the one I happened to purchase. He also wrote one about a trip to Yosemite and one about a trip through the desert in the Palm Springs area.
So then in 1993, you repeated his trip, or at least as much of it as could be replicated given the freeways and sprawl in Los Angeles these days. So what did your friends say, when you said, hey, I'm going to go ride to Oregon? Did people, were they supportive or what?
Well, there were a few who were very supportive. For example, we have a local saddle maker named Gary McClintock, he helped me out. I got the exact same kind of saddle Mr. Chase used. He used a McClellan saddle, and I found an elderly gentleman in El Cajon selling a used one that was an authentic antique, and so I used the exact same kind of saddle. It needed a little bit of work, so Gary did some work on that saddle for me, and he was very supportive. So there were a few people that were supportive, but there were a whole lot of people that thought I had lost my mind. And they had all had their very serious reasons for why I couldn't do this. And having never done it before, I didn't know if I even could. In fact, Gary recommended that I get some advice from a gentleman who'd done quite a bit of rugged riding. And in the advice, he was teaching me how to make fires by rubbing sticks together. I brought matches with me, by the way. But this gentleman, he
did
was...
Did you do that?
I used matches. He was kind of shaking his head, and what he wasn't saying, but what he meant was I was too young, I was too inexperienced, and I was definitely too female to do a ride like this.
Oh, my goodness. How old were you at the time?
I was in my 30s at the time.
I didn't think
it was that young. I had never been actually camping overnight with my horse. In fact, I didn't own a horse at the time.
Really? But you had been riding, though, since you were little. I know you told me in the lobby about a little experience of your first experience on horseback at 3 years old. Can you share that with our listeners?
I'll share that, but I'll, as a preface, say that from the time I was three until I took my first long ride, I was what we call a horseless rider, in that I rode a lot. But typically people paid me to ride their horses for them. Often I was the first one to ride the horse.
You broke the horses then.
I rode people's problem horses. I started horses. I exercised horses. So I had the opportunity to ride a lot of different horses and learn a lot of different styles, which was very advantageous. I got my horse, my first horse, for this long ride is why I got him.
Fascinating.
But my first ride, you asked about my first experience. My first ride, no one else in my family rides horses. My dad rode a little bit when he was growing up, but I grew up in suburban Bakersfield.
And your mom was a Girl Scout leader.
And my mom was a Girl Scout leader. And unfortunately, in Valley Fever, they have that same disease we were talking about that is in El Monte Valley. It's a fungal disease that when the earth gets disturbed and the wind blows, people get very sick.
And so your mother caught Valley Fever.
And my mother caught Valley Fever, so she couldn't take the Girl Scouts that my older sister was in a Girl Scout troop. She couldn't take them horseback riding as they had been promised. And the co-leader didn't want to take the kids, but nobody wanted to disappoint the kids, so my dad agreed. So my dad took the Girl Scouts out horseback riding, but my mom was too sick to look after me. So a little three-year-old tyke came along on the horseback ride. So that was my first horseback ride, and my dad had to contend with trying to get the girls out on the ride and deal with the little three-year-old, and had some difficulty keeping all the girls riding, and they ended up heading back toward the stable, and apparently mine was as barn sour as any, and dad chased me all the way, but my horse got back first. burst and scared the living daylights out of my dad as he tells the story. When he scooped me out of the saddle, instead of being all scared, I said, "Daddy, Daddy, my horsey, go."
Well, and you've been going on horses ever since then, it sounds like. Now, the first ride that you took to Oregon, how long did it take you?
That took 3.5 months. That was on that first horse that I purchased for the trip. Mm-hmm. His name was Cacho. Unfortunately, he had to be put down last year. Mm-hmm. He had liver cancer, but he was 28. He lived a good long life.
Is there a highlight that stands out from that trip for you?
Well, I'll tell you, for both long rides, there are two main points. And the first is that there are just a whole lot of very good and helpful people who would drop everything to help me out along the way. That's the first point. And the second point is we live in a fabulously beautiful place, and the coast of California is just absolutely spectacular. For example, I got to ride an area called the Avenue of the Giants, with the giant redwoods on both sides and elk grazing in the meadow. Just spectacular. 17-mile drive in the Monterey area. I rode that on horseback with the crashing surf and the rocky coastline. Just some spectacularly beautiful places.
What an amazing experience. Now, that was in 1993. Then in 2001, you decided to ride along three historic trails, the Kearney Trail, the Santa Fe Trail, and the Old National Road, all the way basically from Southern California to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and then from Santa Fe to St. Louis, and from there onto the East Coast. How long did that trip take you?
That took 5 months, and if you do the math, you'll see that the horse that I rode to Virginia, it's a different horse, it's my Mustang mare, mm-hmm. she picked up the pace a little bit. She averaged 20 miles a day, whereas Cacho, on the first trip, he averaged 15 miles a day. So the second trip on my more energetic Mustang mare, it took 5 months to cover 3,000 miles, and I'll tell you that 20 miles a day, you know, if you're driving in a car, that doesn't seem like very far. If you're riding on a horse day after day after day for 5 months, 20 miles is a long way. And I was tired at the end of every day. I was ready to crawl in that mm-hmm. tent and get some shut-eye. And my mare was never tired. I would tie her to a tree or a bush or a fence or something like that, and she'd be pacing around. Come on, put the gear back on. Let's go some more.
Wow. Now, I understand that you had a few hair-raising moments on that trip. What happened?
Oh, gosh. Well, probably one of the biggest hazards, even in the days of the wagon train, was weather. And the weather hasn't gotten any easier from the days of the wagon trains until now. And I was within 10 miles of two tornadoes. The second tornado that was very close to where I was in Dodge City, Kansas. And there was a good situation for Shawnee and me because we had mm-hmm. Been introduced to a man who had some big barns and a lot of other horses. And so we had a place to shelter, although if the tornado actually hits, the shelter's not going to help. It only helps in the heavy
Wizard of Oz.
Exactly. So I was helping this. Brad Marshall was the man's name. He runs mm-hmm. this Wild West show for the tourists in Dodge City, Kansas.
Wow.
And I was helping him feed his animals in the storm. And he looked up at the sky with the thunder and lightning and the rain coming down. And he, in his slow Kansas drawl, said, "Well, if it turns into a twister, I'll come up to the barn and get you and bring you down to the cellar."
Oh, boy.
I looked at Shawnee and I said, "Well, it's going to be one heck of a night, because I was spending the night in the barn with Shawnee unless he came up to get me to take me down into the cellar."
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
As it turned out, that tornado didn't hit Dodge City. It hit a nearby town called Rolla, and there were two fatalities in Rolla.
Oh, my goodness. Now, I understand that you're considering taking yet another long ride, and this one would be along the Old Spanish Trail. Where exactly is that?
Well, the Old Spanish Trail predates the Santa Fe Trail, but it's the same kind of idea. When Spain was in charge of New Mexico and Santa Fe and the little settlements throughout there, they forbade trade with California. And so it wasn't until 1822 that trade routes could happen, and it took a little while before there was a wagon route. So before the wagon route, there was a mule route. So the mule route from Santa Fe to California in 1822 developed very quickly, and it went from Santa Fe to California to the trading centers in California, which would have been the Los Angeles area and Monterey.
Hmm. Well, that sounds like a fascinating trip as well, and we'll look forward to hearing all about that. Now, you have written two books about your first two trips. Tell us the names of those and a little bit about what people can read in them.
So the first trip on Cacho is called Chasing the California Dream, and it moves along very quickly. The first draft of it, I had a whole lot of California history and California natural history. And in the version I published, I cut it down to just mostly my stories about the adventures that Cacho and I had going to Oregon. And the second one is called Mustang Journal because the mare I rode to Virginia was born on Bureau of Land Management land. She's a wild Mustang.
Oh, wow.
And in that, I did include a little bit of the history from the historical trails that I was retracing. So there's a little bit of history in that one as well as my personal adventures.
Fascinating. Where can people find the books Chasing the California Dream and Mustang Journal?
Those are available on Amazon.com. The new copies of Mustang Journal are sold out, but there are still used copies available, and there are still new copies of Chasing the California Dream available, and yeah, maybe one day I'll do a ebook version.
Well, very good, and we certainly look forward to having you back when you chase your next dream on the Old Spanish Trail. Thank you so much, Lisa, for joining us on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you, Mary.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Serka Janae Miller, local award-winning novelist, publicist, and journalist. She categorizes her two fiction series as romantic comedy and steamy romance. Welcome, Serka. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's begin with the Between Boyfriends series. I know that the first book was an Amazon bestseller, and it was voted by the organization Read Freely as one of the 50 books worth reading in 2013 and 14. That's very impressive. Why do you think Between Boyfriends has resonated for so many readers?
What they tell me is that they all have a friend like the main character, Jan. She's a bit extreme, but she's completely boy crazy. She just jumps from relationship to relationship. She's always changing who she is to fit the new guy. And as soon as she, you know, gets dumped by one, she's right back in with somebody else. And it's just everybody has a friend like that. So it's kind of fun to make fun of her a little and laugh at her a little. But then she also goes through this period of development. She becomes a much more likable person, someone who focuses on her education, her friends, her family, travels the world. And it's kind of inspiring in a way. That's what people have told me.
And do you think it's because it reminds your readers of a friend, or do you think it reminds them of themselves?
Well, of course they all say a friend, but I think every woman to an extent has a little bit of that in them when they're growing up, where they think that they need to have a boyfriend to be special, or if no one likes them, that means maybe there's something wrong with them. I mean, a lot of us grow out of that, but on some level, I think we can all kind of relate to getting your self-esteem a little bit by who is interested in you.
Right. That sounds like it's got some psychological themes.
There is a little bit. I tried to keep it really light and really funny so that it would be entertaining whether you're interested in some of those kind of themes or whether you just want to read something funny. It works on both levels.
And do you find that it's something that all women, all ages can relate to, or is it really targeted towards younger women?
Well, you know, when you get a book published, they sort of make you define your target audience. And so it does fit into the new adult or college romance category. But I've had 60-year-old women read this and love it. I know teens who've read it and loved it. I've found a lot of women will buy it for their younger daughters, thinking like, oh, this is a subtle way of telling them, like, maybe you should change your priorities a little bit. But then they read it and they like it too.
So it's kind of a universal. And I know you also write steamy romance in the All For You series. So tell us a little bit about that series.
The All For You series is really fun because it's actually a spin-off of the Between Boyfriends series. So the women are now older. Jan was the main character of Between Boyfriends, but mm-hmm. now her friends, Becky and Lisa and Alex, now it's become about all four of them. So it's from all four of their point of views. They've moved to LA. They've all graduated. Three of them are turning 30. So it's a little bit different and it's a lot sexier.
Okay.
So the Between Boyfriends series are pretty much clean romances. The mm-hmm. All For You series has sexual content.
Okay. And so do you find that the audience responds in a different way to that?
Yes. You know, it's interesting. Most of the fans who liked the Between Boyfriends series went ahead and made that jump to the All For You series. And they've said that they love, like, the sort of sexier content, but at the same time, they kind of felt that with Jan's life being what it was when she was younger and still finding herself, that they're kind of glad that that wasn't there in the first series. So it works pretty well.
So it's kind of she was innocent at first, and then you have this progression.
Kind of, yeah.
I know before writing full-time, you were a personal trainer and a massage therapist. How did you get to full-time writing, and how did those careers, along with journalism and publicist work, how did it lead you to fiction?
Well, I always kind of wanted to be an author. When I was a kid, I was like a total bookworm. And so I was always thinking that, well, I'll go to college and I'll get a career and I'll do pretty well. And then maybe someday when I retire, I'll be able to write novels. And so then I went to college and I had a hard time getting a full-time work as a journalist in California. So I decided to go with something else that I really enjoyed, which was fitness, mm-hmm. health and fitness. That's how I got into personal training. Massage therapy was something I kind of fell into. Everybody loves a massage therapist.
Yes.
They're very popular at parties. And it's interesting. So then I did all that, but I kept writing my novels on the side. Mm-hmm. So once I finally had Between Boyfriends done and published that, I was able to make that transition. And actually, Jan is a massage therapist. So I used a lot of what I learned
right
in the novels.
So you write what you know. And I know that selling fiction on Amazon, it's challenging because there's so much out there, both good and bad. As a publicist and an author, what do you think the key is? What would you say to all the writers out there?
Well, there's sort of two ways to make it as an author. There's sort of the traditionally published route where you have a big marketing budget and you're just getting tons of exposure and ads and social media and, you know, being able to get placements in newspapers and magazines to where, you know, you're one of the few people who can afford that. So mm-hmm. your competition is somewhat limited. And that works sometimes and sometimes it doesn't. But the other way, the way that anyone can do, is a bit slower, but it's really focusing on making personal connections with people on Twitter, with people who read your blog, with people you meet on Facebook, with people you meet every day. And the more people you meet, the more they get to like you, then they get interested in your book, and then they help spread the word. And it's sort of more of that grassroots kind of effort.
That's a good way to put it. So you're really building those relationships.
Mm-hmm. You can't be one of those, buy my book people. Nobody likes that. Nobody likes it when anyone does that. There's a much better way to do it, which is more like, get to know me and I want to get to know mm-hmm. you.
Well, speaking of getting to know you, I understand that you were briefly a Buddhist nun. That's an unusual history. How did being a nun segue to writing steamy romance?
Well, yeah, I wasn't working on the steamy romance at the time. It's funny. I'm pretty sure I'm the only person in the world who's been both a best man and some form of a nun. I'm pretty sure. But if there's someone else out there, please let me know, because that'd be great. So I went to Thailand for 2 months for a 1 month trip and then another month to research Between the Sheets. That's my second novel. Mm-hmm. My character goes to Thailand because that's the home of Thai massage and Bangkok is where it started. And that's what she wants to learn as part of her massage therapy. At the same time, she's doing a study abroad program because she's an SDSU student. So I thought, well, I better go and find out what this is all about. And I'd taken Thai massage courses and I love Thai food. It all just sort of made sense. Mm-hmm. And that was when I stumbled into Wat Arun, the Temple of the Dawn, that has a program where people around the world can come and take orders and be a nun, live at the temple, chant with the monks, meditate mm-hmm. four times a day, wow. 4:30 in the morning, whether you want to or not.
Yeah, that's too early.
It was a challenge. And it was a great experience. It was the only time in my life where I kind of felt like I put everything on pause and just focused on meditation and just focused on myself and got out and went home and then started writing the steamy fiction.
So when do you usually do your writing? Is it during the day? Is it at night? Is it like a meditation for you now?
I am a total night owl. I write usually in the afternoons and the evenings. If my brain just won't shut up, well, then I'll write till 3 a.m. if I can. I never try to force it. I know some people do a really good job of having set hours mm-hmm. that they write in, and I encourage anyone to find what works for you. And that does not work for me. I tried it and I just felt blocked and it felt forced. So I now write when I have the ideas and when I feel like it. And for me, the afternoon and the evening is the most productive time.
Good advice. One last question. What are you working on now and when should we expect to see your next project?
I am working on the third book in the All For You series. The first book was a trilogy. The first series was a trilogy. This one is also planned to be a trilogy. Of course, I never planned to write a spinoff, so no.
Right.
No guarantees that there won't be more. But that's what I'm working on now is the third book. There's Aching For You, Falling For You. I have a couple of titles I'm bouncing around for the third one. I really like to figure out the title at the end. I might have some ideas, but I want to make sure because I'm one of those people who, when I write, I don't really know where it's going to go for
certain.
Yes, I'm more of they call it a pantser, which got a huge laugh at our last author panel because somebody asked, are you a pantser or a plotter? And a lot of the audience members didn't know what a pantser was. So I explained, no, it's not someone who goes around pantsing people like you do in elementary school. It's someone who writes by the seat of their pants. And so that's how I am. And I won't be sure what I'm going to call it until I'm done.
Well, do you know if the next project after that will be a series or you think you'll do an individual book or will it be the same genre?
I have been working on a fantasy novel, and if that is what I'm going to finish next, I'm not sure. It's probably going to be a series, but I'm not sure. I always have these ideas. I have a script I've been working on. I have like 4 other ideas for scripts. I don't know that if I'll get to them, so I don't know. We'll have to see.
Well, we'll have to see and find out. Well, Sarika, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
For more information on Sarika Janae Miller and her work, please visit her website at sarikajanae.com. And I'll spell that for you, SarikaJonae. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you've been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This summer, grab a book and help a parent. This was the kickoff for the County Library Summer Reading Challenge. From now through August, kids of all ages are encouraged to read and help raise money for the Parent Education and Adoption Center. For every child or adult who reads for 20 hours or 20 books, $5 will be donated to the Parent Rescue Group.
Reading over the summer is very important for kids. Studies show that kids who read at least 5 books over the summer do not experience any reading loss from the previous school year.
Our organization is Parent Education and Adoption Center, PEACE. We adopt out birds, we rescue, and we focus on education. We just want to thank San Diego Libraries and also the Department of Animal Services for giving us this great opportunity.
Sign up and keep a reading log on the County Library's website. In the County News Center, I'm Michael Russo.
Now it's it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report, or perhaps in this case, a not-so-green report. Last year, our award-winning investigative story titled Was It Fraud? Raised serious questions over why Pattern Energy's Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility produced only 15% capacity factor in 2013. That's far less than the 34% capacity factor that Pattern promised the federal government in order to obtain lucrative federal subsidies. Even after accounting for time when a fallen blade shut down the project, capacity factor for the remaining months still averaged less than 19%. Now, the figures are in for 2014, and guess what? The Ocotillo Wind Project again underperformed, this time reaching 24% capacity factor. Only 2 months, May and June, exceeded the 34% that Pattern had predicted. The rest fell short, in some cases by huge margins. 2 months produced less than 7% capacity factor, for example. International energy expert Nicholas Picard had predicted before the project was built that the site did not have enough wind energy to sustain a wind project. After the first year figures proved his prediction was accurate, Picard told us that the federal government appeared to have enough evidence to pursue a false claims action against Pattern. But the government ignored the evidence and did nothing. Maps submitted by Pattern to win approval made it appear that the project would be located at an elevation 3,000 feet higher than the actual site, as documents that we published last year proved. We brought these issues to the attention of Congressman Juan Vargas, who represents the community of Ocotillo as well as East County. We sent numerous documents and expert statements. In March of 2014, we got a response from Congressman Vargas's staffer, Diana Zamora, in his Washington, D.C. office. Back then, she assured us that the congressman takes any accusations of impropriety or fraud very seriously. He has reached out to the Department of Energy to share with them the information you have provided. She also said that Congressman Vargas had asked the best method for evaluating the information to determine if any wrongdoing has occurred, and she promised to get back to us just as soon as she heard back about the Department of Energy's evaluation. But more than a year later, she has not done so. Meanwhile, Pattern continues to receive subsidies for each megawatt of power that it does produce, with zero accountability for building a wind project on a site that the federal government's own wind resource map showed was substandard for an industrial-scale wind energy facility. Nor is this the only indication of misleading claims made by Pattern. We have previously documented dubious claims made about earthquake safety, avian radar, health, worker safety, jobs, wildlife issues, and more at a project that has also been linked to Dust Bowl-scale dust storms and pollution of Ocotillo waterways, as well as residential areas contaminated with a flammable dust suppression chemical, as well as endangering public safety when an 11-ton blade fell off on an off-roader's trail, as our many award-winning reports on this topic has documented. Pattern Energy also drew criticism from many Native American tribes and the California Native American Heritage Commission for desecrating sacred sites and burial grounds. The project also destroyed groves of century-old Ocotillo plants for which the town itself was named. It left residents plagued by noise, infrasound, and flashing red lights from turbines shining in their windows all night long, as well as lost views on protected public land surrounding the town and plummeting property values. With so many negative impacts, the consequences for residents, the environment, and taxpayers are high. So the question remains, why hasn't our government taken action to hold the developer responsible for pocketing your money to build a wind project without adequate wind? This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement. Royalty-free music. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.